In a sense, the trade union identity of the conference is more important. The subject of the conference is lesbian, gay men and transgender and discrimination against us in the workplace.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. It's good news and bad as the Egyptian riverboat raid cases are reopened, trade unionists plan to work it out at an international conference down under, and lyrical rock, power pop, and traditional jazz burst from the audiophile. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending May 25th, 2002. Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak this week reopened the cases of 50 of the 53 men arrested a year ago in a police raid on a gay-friendly riverboat nightclub in Cairo. That's good news for 21 who were convicted of debauchery with men in November and sentenced to 3 years hard labor, but not for the 29 who were acquitted who are expected to be arrested again soon. All 50 had been tried by an emergency state security court set up to deal with accused terrorists, whose rulings can be reconsidered only by the president in his capacity as military leader. All could now face retrial before an ordinary civil court at prosecutor's discretion. A spokesperson for Mubarak said he did not view the debauchery charges as appropriate for a state security court. But the president also confirmed the 5-year and 3-year sentences of two other arrestees who had been presented as ringleaders in a cult and were additionally convicted of contempt for religion. The 53rd arrestee was a minor who was tried in a civil court and freed on appeal.
Mubarak was apparently responding to widespread international protest of the Cairo raid, the reported torture of the arrestees during their detention, and a number of other arrests in an apparent crackdown on gay men over the last year. But activists are far from satisfied and view with outrage the possibility of retrial for those already acquitted. Among those protesting Egypt's actions against suspected gay men were 40 U.S. Congress members who this week received a response to a letter they wrote in March. Egypt's ambassador to the U.S., Nabil Fahmy, declared that the debauchery statute is designed to punish promiscuity and prostitution and that there is no distinction or discrimination based on a person's sexual orientation. Openly gay Democratic Congressmember Barney Frank rejected the claim, saying Egyptian authorities are applying this law virtually exclusively against adult gay men who are doing no harm to others, and this shows that a clear and active anti-gay policy exists in Egypt.
The U.S. Congress Republican leadership this week prevented a floor vote on the so-called Michael Judge bill, named for the openly gay New York Fire Department chaplain who died in the September 11th attack on the World Trade Center. The Democrat-controlled Senate had unanimously passed the bill, which would have extended survivor benefits to anyone named as a beneficiary in a will or insurance policy by Judge and 9 other public safety officers who died in the attack without leaving a surviving spouse, child, or parent. Those are the only legal beneficiaries in current federal law. In Judge's case, the bill would have extended the benefits of about $250,000 per victim to his sisters, but the Bush administration and House Republican leadership are believed to have objected not only to increased costs for the future, but also to the bill's inclusion of unmarried domestic partners, regardless of gender.
However, those concerns did not stop New York's Republican Governor George Pataki from signing into law this week the state's similar September 11th Victims and Families Relief Act, which explicitly ensures gay and lesbian partners' eligibility for state-level benefits and expresses the state government's intention that they should receive federal benefits as well.
And the Democrat-controlled California State Assembly, in a party-line vote this week, approved a bill to ensure that gays and lesbians who have registered their domestic partnerships with the state will inherit part of their partner's estates if there is no will. the bill moves next to the California State Senate.
The American Psychoanalytic Association last week, by an overwhelming majority, adopted a position statement in support of gay and lesbian parents. It said in part that evaluation of an individual or a couple for parental qualities should be determined without prejudice regarding sexual orientation. Gay and lesbian individuals and couples are capable of meeting the best interest of the child and should be afforded the same rights and should accept the same responsibilities as heterosexual parents. The statement referred to decisions in areas including conception, child rearing, adoption, visitation, and custody.
The Indiana Court of Appeals reached a somewhat similar conclusion last week, unanimously affirming that judges cannot deny custody or visitation rights to gay and lesbian parents solely because they live with a partner of the same gender. Their parental rights can be denied only if there is harm to the child. The ruling struck down a Marshall County policy which had denied custody to parents residing with an unmarried partner, regardless of gender.
Britain's move towards opening adoption to gay and lesbian couples survived another challenge this week, as an amendment to explicitly exclude them from the Adoption and Child Bill was defeated by a landslide in the House of Commons, where the Labour Party holds a huge majority. The amendment was introduced by two Conservative Party members of Parliament. Conservative leader Ian Duncan Smith had declared earlier that the party's opposition was not motivated by homophobia, but by a desire that all adoptive parents should be married, something gays and lesbians can't legally achieve in the UK.
Ireland's Equality Authority has included adoption and fostering rights for gay and lesbian couples among the recommendations in a report on sexual orientation discrimination issued this week after 2 years of study. The government-appointed panel also advises on equality issues of 8 other protected categories. Irish law does not recognize same-gender partnerships at all, while offering little recognition even to unmarried heterosexual couples, creating inequities in inheritance, pensions, property, taxation, and welfare, as well as parenting. Although the parenting recommendations are expected to prove the most controversial, the Equality Authority's recommendations in support of gays, lesbians, and bisexuals range widely from representation on community planning boards to anti-prejudice programming by broadcasters. The Equality Authority calls for changes in policies, laws, and even the Irish Constitution to achieve equal status for gays, lesbians, and bisexuals individually and as same-gender couples.
Denmark was the world's first nation to create registered partnerships extending most of the legal rights and responsibilities of marriage to gay and lesbian couples, but artificial insemination was not among them. Gays and lesbians have been demanding the right to use artificial insemination legally, while hundreds have been doing so outside the law at private clinics. Minister of Health Lars Løkke Rasmussen has called for a commission to draft ethical guidelines for artificial insemination for them, along with single people and people with HIV.
Legal recognition of same-gender couples was called for this week even in Croatia, where gays and lesbians are rarely heard from and will only be holding their first public pride event this year. Both the gay group Iskorak and the lesbian group Kontra called for immediate recognition of same-gender couples equal to that of common-law heterosexual couples and for amending the law defining marriage to read a union of two persons instead of a man and a woman.
Britain's earliest known transsexual lived some 1,700 years ago, archaeologists announced this week. It's taken them 20 years to reach this conclusion about a skeleton found as part of 40 years ongoing excavations into Roman ruins near Catterick. Unlike any other male skeleton yet found in a late Roman cemetery in Britain, this one was buried wearing a jet necklace and bracelet, a shale armlet, and a bronze anklet, typically female jewelry with some mystical connotations for the period. Forensic tests on the 4th century skeleton have now revealed it belonged to a castrated male. The archaeologists believe this was a Gallus, one of the worshippers of the Roman earth goddess Cybele, who ritually castrated themselves and thereafter dressed as women, including feminine jewelry, hairstyles, and colorful clothes.
The Ford Motor Company this week announced that its new chief financial officer is open gay Alan Gilmore. The longtime Ford exec and former Ford vice chair publicly identified himself as a gay man after his retirement in 1995, having feared it would hurt the company had he come out earlier. He went on to support gay and lesbian groups with fundraising and contributions and to lecture about his experiences, as well as running a small car dealership in his native Vermont. Ford Chair and CEO Bill Ford said this week of Gilmore, "He's helped us through tough times before and helped us to record profitability before. This is definitely a tough time for Ford, which lost nearly $5.5 billion last year."
And finally, Rosie O'Donnell wound up her TV talk show this week after 6 years and 10 Emmy Awards with what openly gay actor Nathan Lane called the biggest, gayest celebration since Liza's wedding. The huge party featured a big number with the cast of several Broadway hits and video clips that included O'Donnell's pregnant partner, Kelly Carpenter. When O'Donnell publicly declared her lesbian orientation earlier this year as part of her advocacy for adoptions, one of the obvious questions was her notorious crush on film star Tom Cruise. As she put it in her network television interview with Diane Sawyer, "I never once said I wanted him naked in bed doing the nasty. I want him to mow my lawn and to get me a lemonade." And so the last moments of O'Donnell's finale showed Cruise pushing a lawnmower and then approaching the camera, drink in hand, to say, "Rosie, I cut your lawn. Here's your lemonade."
That's News Wrap for the week ending May 25th, 2002. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
Coming up later in the program, you'll be charmed by the debut of a blissfully ragged lesbian, hop along to the power pop of a harmony bunny, and hear a musical response to the president who gave Too Little Too Late.
Our union story is there to be seen. We've won many victories and we've suffered defeats. But as I turn through the pages and look back through time, one single question stands out in my mind. Today we may prosper, today we live free, but if it weren't for the union, where would we be? It's our union that defends our rights. But our union's as strong as our will is to fight. For the union is you, and the union is me. So stand up and stand by our union.
A series of social justice conferences are being planned for the week leading up to the quadrennial Gay Games being held this November in Sydney, Australia. One of them is Workers Out, the second world conference of lesbian and gay trade unionists, where labor activists will build on the work started at their first conference at the Amsterdam Gay Games in 1998. The foundation has been laid, and according to Workers Out organizing committee member Ken Davis, promoting participation at the 2002 gathering down under is the top priority right now. He discusses the conference in conversation with This Way Out's Michael Schembri.
The first conference, the Conference on Trade Unionists, Homosexuality and Work, was held just before the Gay Games in Amsterdam in 1998. How does the second conference in Sydney 2002 go beyond the first one?
I think the first conference was very important in putting the issues on the table, although, certainly by 1998, in a lot of countries, a lot of lesbians and gay men had made enormous gains in their own trade union movement. It's not like before 1998, this wasn't a topic within trade unions, but it's very different, this second conference, in terms of the thrust and the content and the objectives, because in 2000, for example, the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions included fighting sexuality discrimination at work, you know, in its resolutions. And that's a big victory. We've really got to take that forward, you know, to really situate the struggle against sexuality discrimination in the workplace within the overall commitment by the trade union movement worldwide to fight for social justice. The other way that I think this conference will be different is inevitably at the Amsterdam Gay Games, the conference there was dominated by people from Europe, to an extent from North America, and they had good participation from Latin America and to an extent from Southern Africa. We're really hoping that this conference, because it's situated in Sydney, can have good participation from the East Asia, Indian Ocean and Pacific Ocean regions. You know, we have the endorsement of Sharon Burrow, who's not only head of the ACTU, but president of the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions Asia-Pacific region, where more than 60% of the workers of the world live.
Can you expand on the aims for the Sydney conference?
There's a range of aims. I mean, obviously, the first aim is so that people can share experiences in their workplaces, in their sectors, in their regions, and you know, how they're taking forward their issues within their union structures. The second really, though, is how do we advance the agenda for lesbian and gay rights and transgender rights in the trade union movement in the world? And also, we want to really address the situation of people with HIV and other chronic infections, the occupational health side of it, but also the commitment of the trade union movement to questions such as accessibility of treatments and medical care. So the objectives are a bit broader, and we're getting a lot of requests from a range of countries that this conference look at the relationship between the struggles of transgender, lesbian and gay workers and the overall anti-globalisation political struggle. So it's also an important moment in terms of internationalism.
Is the conference only for gay men, lesbians and transgenders?
No, the conference is really for trade unionists. So, for example, you know, a trade union may delegate a national gender officer or a national equity officer or a national human rights officer to come to the conference. So in a sense, the trade union identity of the conference is more important. The subject of the conference is lesbians, gay men and transgender and people with HIV and discrimination against us in the workplace.
What kind of endorsements have you received for this conference?
The conference has been endorsed by three of what are called the Global Union Federations. They're sectoral bodies, so Education International, Public Services International, and the International Federation of Journalists. We're seeking endorsement from the other seven global union federations. We're seeking endorsement from the International Confederation of Free Trade Unions, the national union federations in Australia and in Canada and in Britain have endorsed so far, and we believe other national federations will endorse. Particular organisations such as the International Lesbian and Gay Association and Pride at Work in the United States have endorsed, and particular unions like Unison in Britain, which is the largest union in Europe, and you know, Canadian auto workers are amongst the people that have sent funding.
Now, I'm assuming that people will need to register for the conference. How would that happen?
The best way to get in touch with the conference or to register is through our website, which is www.workersout.com.
It does cost money to attend a conference like this. What is the cost?
Well, there's two answers to that. If people are registering, I think the full cost is $300 Australian, which for people from some countries is an awful lot of money, and people from, say, United States is really not very much at all. We're hoping, though, that unions will sponsor their own delegates. Union donor organisations like Friedrich Ebert Stiftung from Germany, we're hoping that they will sponsor participation. We do have some scholarship money, and so people from gay and lesbian organisations or trade unions in you know, resource-poor situations, particularly in Indian Ocean region, East Asia or the Pacific, can apply for scholarships to come. And the application for that is through our website. The other thing is, even if people can't come, if they want to email suggestions for content or resolutions or issues or messages of support for the conference, all of that, you know, is through the website on www.workersout.com.
That was Ken Davis, a member of the organizing committee of Workers Out, the Second World Conference of Lesbian and Gay Trade Unionists, scheduled for October 31st through November 2nd in Sydney, Australia. He spoke with our correspondent in Sydney, Michael Schembri.
They say we've got problems and the unions they blame. Well, Franco and Pinochet, they said the same. If our union they weaken, if our union they break, then where's our defense from becoming enslaved? So would you choose bondage above liberty? And if it weren't for the union, where would we be? It's our union that defends our rights. But our union's as strong as our will is to fight. For the union is you, and the union is me. So stand up and stand by our union.
Of course there is such a thing as a gay sensibility. Of course gay men and women think in some fundamental ways differently from straights. It is not just about what we do in bed. It is about the echoes in the culture of who we are or who we aren't. Hi, I'm Clive Barker. Listen to This Way Out, the international gay and lesbian news magazine.
Say hello to three new voices on the gay and lesbian music scene, voted most likely to succeed this month by the keepers of The Audiophile.
Coming down the side of the mountain, pavement turns gravel, turns dirt beneath the wheels. No way to turn back, no reason to turn back. Time on our side is a slow, patient guide. Life is sweet and strange. Life is sweet and strange. Life is sweet and strange. Life is sweet and strange.
Sarah Pinsker's debut CD is called Charmed, and with it we get her creative lyrics delivered in a package of catchy folk-flavored rock. Hi, I'm Christopher David Trentum.
I'm Chris Wilson, and you're listening to Audiophile. Another element of Sarah's CD that is Charmed is that it was produced by Sonia of Disappear Fear, who also sings backup, and you can't do much better than that.
We used to call it folk and roll, and it got a whole lot more rock, so these days it's kind of straight up rock and roll with the lyrics first. Someone called it blissfully ragged melodicism, and I liked that one.
You can find out more about Sarah Pinsker and her CD Charmed at www.sarahpinsker.com. That's www.sarahpinsker.com.
Drew Peralik is a very lyrical composer of standard jazz. His first CD is called Too Little, Too Late.
The title track from the CD, Too Little, Too Late, is pretty important to me. That had to do when I was a member of ACT UP in New York. A speech by the then President Bush spurred me on to write the melody.
Peralik's CD has a variety of moods and can take you smoothly from mellow to up-tempo.
You can learn more about Drew Peralik and his CD, Too Little, Too Late, at www.cdbaby.com/Peralik. That's cdbaby.com/PARALIC. John Ashfield's debut CD is called Harmony Bunny.
and with it, he brings us his own brand of the music style called power pop.
Find out more about John Ashfield and his CD, Harmony Bunny, at www.johnashfieldmusic.com.
And that's it for this edition of Audiophile. You can write to us at Post Office Box 429, Sunland, California, 91041, or by visiting our brand new website at www.audiophile.org. That's www.audiofile.org.
Audiophile is produced by Chris Wilson, J.D. Doyle, and Christopher David Trentum. I'm Chris Wilson.
And I'm Christopher David Trentum. Keep listening.
She started smoking when she's 9 years old.
Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, Christopher Gall, Graham Underhill, Jason Lynn, Chris Ambidge, Brian Nunes, Rex Walkner, Michael Schembri, and Chris Wilson, Christopher David Trentum, and J.D. Doyle contributed program material. Peter Hicks performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's an easy link to the show from our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. To learn how you can help in This Way Out's critical struggle to stay on the air, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening on WMNF Tampa, Florida, KRCC Colorado Springs, Colorado, CKUW Winnipeg, Manitoba, and more than 125 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Everybody's going to stay tuned.